Marketplace is supported by Putnam Investments, managing absolute return funds for all kinds of investors. Details at putnam.com. Produced in association with the University of Southern California.
It's not a surprise today's report on gross domestic product. Unless you've been living under a rock, you know the economy is in deep and serious trouble. What might not have been clear, though, is what a tumbling GDP means for how to get out of this mess. From American Public Media, this is Marketplace.
Marketplace is supported by Constant Contact, dedicated to helping small businesses and nonprofits build stronger customer relationships through email marketing. ConstantContact.com. Coverage of Asia is supported by the Freeman Foundation.
From the Frank Stanton Studios in Los Angeles, I'm Kai Rizdahl. Today is Friday, the 27th of February. Glad to have you with us. We had a guy on the program a couple of months ago who said he thought the economy was going to get worse before it got worse. I'm pretty sure that's where we wound up today. The Commerce Department shared its most recent estimate of gross domestic product with us this morning. GDP fell 6.2% in the fourth quarter of last year. That is almost twice as bad as the government's first guess. Now, bearing in mind that the U.S. economy is an enormously complicated thing, it would seem that, especially now, getting the GDP number right would be especially helpful. We asked Marketplace's Steve Henn what the heck happened.
Turns out this huge downward revision of GDP isn't a big surprise for many economists.
The initial numbers were just not to be believed at all.
Diane Swank at Mesirow Financial says when the Commerce Department releases its first guess for the gross domestic product, it really is guessing. Data on trade and business inventories aren't in yet.
So they always have to guess.
Chris Lowe's at FTN Financial.
Normally it's pretty easy to do, but right now exports are falling off more rapidly than we've ever seen.
In this economy, the Commerce Department's models didn't work at all. They overestimated the amount businesses would spend on inventories by $25 billion, inflating GDP. But Lowe says the fact that businesses spent less is actually good news.
The biggest fear in a recession is that products start to pile up on the shelves to such an extent that stores don't need to order anything anymore.
That leads to more layoffs. But don't get too excited. The Commerce Department also overestimated consumer spending and business spending on big-ticket items, which fell an astounding 27%.
That's never happened before. It's just spectacular how fast things are falling apart.
If that's enough to drive you to drink, you're not alone. Diane Swank says booze is
one of the few strong points in the economy, too.
Year-over-year sales of alcohol is one place the economy is still growing. In Washington, I'm Steve Henn for Marketplace.
There is a little piece of Newtonian physics in macroeconomics. I'm thinking here about the part of every reaction to having an equal and opposite reaction. Thinking about the president's budget plan, too, the one that came out yesterday. The White House is expecting GDP to slow just 1.2% for all of this year and then grow by more than 3% next year. I asked Brookings Institution economist Barry Bosworth what happens to the president's economic plan if, as seems plausible, given today's numbers, we don't see that.
Well, I think that they do have a forecast that assumes that this huge crisis is going to end awfully soon. I think most outside economists would say this is going to be harder than that. If they do, they're not going to have the type of revenue that they're projecting for 2010, 2011, 2012. It's just a period of enormous uncertainty, and they really don't know how much resources they're going to have available to them.
What about the other big part of the president's budget plan that came out yesterday, his plan to cut the deficit by $2 trillion over 10 years? How can we do that if we have negative GDP growth this year and really weak growth next year?
You have to have very strong growth to achieve this. I guess I would argue, forget about the budget deficit for the next 2 years. We got to try to save the economy. Once we have a strong economy, I believe history shows it's pretty easy to reduce budget deficits.
I wanted to take the premise of my earlier question and apply it to the nation's banking system. There has been much made of this stress test that the Treasury Department's going to put the banks through. But that stress test assumes a certain bad economic scenario, 2% economic shrinkage over the next couple of years. And in fact, today, here we have 6%. What does that say about whether or not the banks are going to be able to come back?
Well, you got to remember, if you're going to do a stress test, you want to do a bad situation. There's no point to it otherwise. So you should not confuse the two forecasts. The stress test, I think, is a legitimate negative type economic development can these banks withstand that kind of situation? I think it's a very good idea. I think the basic parameters of it have been quite well designed. But it's not meant to be a forecast of where the economy is going to go.
But are we stressing them enough? I guess that's my point.
You could argue for even a more negative outcome. That's a possibility. But I think we'll learn a lot from this. There's not a lot of sense to asking people what would happen if something so bad as 1% probability should recur.
Let me ask you this, though. If we come back to you the next time gross domestic product numbers come out for the first quarter of this year, and they are equally bad or worse, how might our conversation go that day? Would you be more worried?
Yes. I expect them to be very bad for the first quarter. Everything I see, the economy is still basically in free fall. I think that without an economic recovery, it's hard to go ahead with this agenda that the president had before the crisis. In his campaign, he had a very well-articulated program and policies that he wanted to do. And then the world got hit with an enormous shock, and everything's changed. They seem to have a bit of trouble understanding the extent to which the world has changed on them and how much just dealing with the economic crisis that we're now in is going to absorb all of their time.
Barry Bosworth, an economist at the Brookings Institution. Mr. Bosworth, thanks a lot for your time.
Thank you.
Citigroup announced this morning the government's agreed to become its single largest shareholder. The Treasury Department's going to convert up to $25 billion of its current stash of preferred shares and turn them into common stock. That means Joe taxpayer's stake in the banking giant will be around 36%. And it does not offer much assurance that this transaction with Citi will be Uncle Sam's last. From New York, Ashley Milne-Tite reports.
When analysts determine the value of a company, they look at its tangible common equity, basically its cash and assets. Jamie Cox, managing partner at Harris Financial Group, says Citi's common equity has been shrinking fast.
Because their capital is being depleted by the write-downs that they're having to take on their mortgage-backed securities and all of their asset-backed securities. So what this does, essentially, is shore up their capital base to be able to give them time to sell off these assets
and reduce the massive gap between what they have and what they owe. Gerard Cassidy directs bank equity research at RBC Capital Markets. He says the more cash and assets, or common equity, the bank has on hand, the easier it is to weather hard times.
So if you start to build up your common equity, you are building up your ability to handle greater losses as we go forward.
There's a chance those losses could still be overwhelming, and common shareholders, aka taxpayers, are the last to get their money back in the event of a liquidation. Cassidy doesn't think that's a likely scenario in Citi's case. Still, the government may not be done helping Citi out.
If you are in the camp that the economy is going to weaken considerably more, then no, this is probably not the last time capital will have to be infused into Citi.
Cassidy says he is cautiously hopeful this could be the last time. In New York, I'm Ashley Milne-Tite for Marketplace.
Citi shares, by the way, dropped 39% today. The Dow flirted with 7,000 on the way down. We'll have the details when we do the numbers. We've come to that part of a Friday where we pause to reflect, if that is the right word, on the 5 days gone by. Here to help us with our weekly wrap of Wall Street and beyond are Lee Gallagher from Fortune Magazine. Also, John Carney from ClusterStock.com. Hello to you both.
Hi,
thanks
guys
for having us.
So we have to riff on the top of the news, obviously, to start with, John, and we'll go to you just because. Let's see, the Citibank news this morning, the GDP news. Any surprise at all here to you?
The GDP news was horrific, and I think it was surprising that it was actually that bad.
Well, Lee, how much more of this can we take then, do you think?
You know, it was a big shocker today. You know, I don't know how much more we can take, but we will need to take more. I think the consensus is that is still things are going to get worse or likely to get worse before they get better. I think, you know, we saw Bernanke's sobering assessment earlier this week that a full recovery is at least a year away and could be longer. And even that may be optimistic at this point.
Just because we can, John, let me ask you to veer into this topic of nationalization and take off on that Citigroup news of today. Here now, we're going to own 36-38% of this bank. We're going to, you know, replace half the board, but still, how much has really changed?
I think a huge problem with the kind of half measures that we've been taking so far is that we don't really change that much. Vikram Pandit's job, the head of Citi, is apparently perfectly safe. The entire upper management below Vikram Pandit, the people who actually got Citi into the mess it's in, they're not leaving. They're not being asked to leave. They're not being replaced. And in a sense, what we've done is made the U.S. government a massive passive shareholder. We don't want the government running banks. But by kind of doing these half nationalization, you know, or what is it, you know, a third nationalization now, we may be kind of enabling them to continue on with their problems without having to face up to how bad their balance sheet really is.
Do me a favor, though, John, and take a look at the broader spectrum here for a minute. We've got the Dow back to where it was in 97, 98. We've got housing numbers worse than we've seen in 25 years. GDP, obviously, we had this morning. It is almost like we're going backwards, isn't it?
If you had, you know, graduated from college in the mid-90s and started doing what you were told to do, which was put away some money, you save for the future, plug 10% of your income into your 401k, you've basically just made no money at all in the markets. That's a really sobering, depressing thought, and I think it actually will have a long-term implication for the way people invest in the future. We're always told, you know, invest for the long run. Well, we've had the long run, and it hasn't really gotten us anywhere. We've been running in place, essentially.
Okay, so Lee, that leaves it to you to provide the hoped-for, optimistic, bright note to end our conversation this week. I mean, if it is as bad as all that, there's got to be something good to come out of it.
Well, it's interesting. I mean, we actually have a story coming out in our issue that's out next week that points out that of these toxic assets that everyone's, you know, talking about on the bank's balance sheets, it's really the big unknown here. A lot of them are actually fairly valued or undervalued, which means that, you know, vultures are in fact already stirring to get their hands on some of this stuff. So that's a good thing. Now, the bad point with that is that what is still unknown is the debt or the defaults that might come from a whole other sort of black hole of debt, which involves credit, consumer loans, commercial finance loans. So there's more stuff that could come up on the bank's balance sheets that we don't even know about yet.
No, man, you were supposed to be the bright note. That was not the ender that I was looking for.
Here's a bright note. You know, I do think when Obama came out this week and addressed Congress, I think that there was a message there that was, you know, we will recover. And I think that we really needed to hear that. And that's a psychological thing, but I think that that went a long way to just sort of, okay, let's just hold on and you know, we are going to get out of this. But, you know, how the government deals with the banks is essential to the broad economic recovery, and that's the big question here. Are we going to nationalize or are we not? And as John pointed out, the Citi move today was just more of the same.
See, now you brought us up and then you brought us back down again. Lee Gallagher at Fortune Magazine. John Carney writes for ClusterStock.com. Thanks, guys.
Thanks,
Thank
Kai.
You.
Chinese regulators have been giving a plant owned by New Jersey-based Wyeth Pharmaceuticals a close going over and, just yesterday, a clean bill of health. The company is the latest to be wrapped up in the scandal over industrial chemicals turning up in Chinese-made milk powder. Despite fears over China's spotty product safety record, international investment does keep flowing in. The Chinese economy is still growing, and American entrepreneurs are still there chasing opportunities, even in the dairy business, as Marketplace's Scott Tong reports.
Imagine this. You're shopping in the milk section of the grocery store, and you don't trust that any brand is safe. That's the state of China's dairy industry. Tainted infant formula has killed 6 babies, and the chemical melamine has been found in every Chinese brand of milk. So consumers are scrambling for something safe.
I think this is a tremendous opportunity. I think it's the right time.
Enter Lloyd Ward, an entrepreneur with Fortune 500 pedigree. He once ran Maytag, as well as the U.S. Olympic Committee. But today, Ward is co-founder of a milk industry startup in middle-of-nowhere China. Why?
There is a compelling need. Chinese consumers understand product quality, and you may have to pay more to get products that truly are safe.
Ward is selling high-end organic milk at a high-end price of $4 a quart, and he promises quality in the form of a secure supply chain. In most of China, that doesn't exist. There are lots of middlemen, tens of thousands of family farmers who feed their cows who knows what.
When you have a supply chain that is segmented, as much as this supply chain was segmented, there are just too many opportunities for things to go wrong.
Ward's outfit controls every link in the chain at its pasture in Inner Mongolia. It owns every one of the 2,000 cows, everything they're fed. No pesticides, no fertilizers, no antibiotics. Dong Run Lee manages this pasture. And to him, it's not so much pasture as cow spa.
Our cows' activities are unrestricted. They're totally free. Those cows there are sunbathing. Over here, they're eating and sleeping in their own space. Cows have feelings like people. If they're happy, they produce good milk.
The Cows Are People Too approach produces premium content at the milking station, top levels of protein and fat. And Lloyd Ward is banking on middle-class parents in China willing to pay top dollar for it.
Parents will buy for themselves the low-end product, and they buy for their kids the expensive product. It's kind of like the U.S. back in the 40s, where we knew that we wanted our kids to have a better life.
So as China gets rich, its food sector oozes with opportunity. Just beware the risks. Bruce McLaughlin of Synergy Consultants says too many foreign investors rush in like lemmings, pick a local partner they don't know very well, and disaster strikes. That just happened to a New Zealand milk company that got burned by the melamine scandal.
China's not a magic money-making machine. There's great opportunities there, but you have to do things right. And people go in and do unbelievably stupid things that they'd never do if they were investing in Europe or investing in America.
Entrepreneur Lloyd Ward is willing to take on the risks of China and the frustrations. Virtually every American manager here will vent about cultural differences, how they make for staff inefficiencies, and meetings that go nowhere.
In Maytag, when you came in, you had an agenda, and you had a half hour, and we would work through all the critical issues. What are your options, and what do you recommend? I never get that in a Chinese meeting. Never. Never.
Still, Lloyd Ward says it's all worth it if he can give a little back and share some corporate America expertise in a developing country. The challenge, though, is to sell his product in a nervous dairy market. Ward is hoping it'll calm down this spring or summer. That's when he plans to roll out some new milk products, organic milk for Chinese babies and pregnant women. In Inner Mongolia, China, I'm Scott Tong for Marketplace.
Coming up, serving up sloppy joes to stay employed.
I just love working with kids. That makes my day. These little kids will tell you anything.
But first, let's do the numbers. Considering the news today, things on Wall Street could have been worse. As it was, the Dow Industrials dialed back 1 2/3%, 119 points, finished at 7,062. The NASDAQ lost just under 1%, 13 points, finished at 1,377. The S&P 500 shed 2 1/3%, that is 17 points. Ended the day, the week, and the month at 735. For the week that is finally over, the Dow threw off 4%. The NASDAQ rolled back 4 4/10%. The S&P 500 gave up 4.5%. Banks ended the day on a down note. Citigroup, I mentioned, down 39%. Bank of America traded down almost 26% on similar concerns to Citigroup. It's worried the government might be taking a bigger role in a lot of banks. Wells Fargo threw off 16%. You're listening to Marketplace.
Marketplace is supported by Palm Wonderful, 100% pomegranate juice in the curvy bottle, the antioxidant superpower. Information at pomwonderful.com. And by saveandinvest.org, helping military service members and families manage their money with confidence by providing unbiased financial information, tools, and more. Online at saveandinvest.org. Let us do the work for you. Download Marketplace's After the Bell, a podcast which makes sense of a week's worth of business news. Just go to marketplace.org and click on the podcast link.
From the Marketplace Datebook, here's a look at events coming up on Monday. The Commerce Department releases reports on personal income and construction spending for January. The Federation of American Hospitals holds its annual public policy conference and business expo. And on this day in 1933, the original King Kong movie had its world premiere in New York. I'm Daryl Perinata.
This is Marketplace from American Public Media. I'm Kai Rizdahl. Mark this one down in the column labeled yet another small but troubling signal of banking problems. Today, the Federal Deposit Insurance Corporation raised its rates. That is, the FDIC increased the premiums it charges banks for the deposit insurance that they're required to carry. That's the insurance that covers you up to $250,000 if your bank fails, like mine did, actually. The agency also imposed a one-time emergency assessment to cover mounting losses from bank failures. The FDIC has shut down 14 banks so far this year and sold off what's left to healthier financial institutions. Marketplace's Mitchell Hartman reports now on one of the latest, Silver Falls Bank, outside Portland, Oregon.
Lark Weisham chairs the Oregon Bankers Association. Last week, she and her staff at Citizens Bank of Corvallis were invited to bid on rival Silver Falls Bank. The FDIC had told them it was about to fail.
So the bid process is through a secure website. There are times in which you can actually go into the bank and do due diligence.
Citizens Bank got $100 million in deposits plus three local branches. The FDIC got the rest.
So any other liability other than deposits that the bank had, any troubled loans that they may have to take a loss on, that's their anticipated price to the insurance fund.
The FDIC's hit for Silver Falls, $50 million. It's chump change in the grand scheme of things, but some recent bank failures have been huge. IndyMac alone cost nearly $11 billion. The FDIC says it'll need $65 billion to cover bank failures over the next 4 years, which is why it's hiking insurance premiums on the banks that are left. Some bankers say the FDIC should tap into Treasury funds instead, but finance professor Stuart Greenbaum of Washington University says that's the wrong way to go.
It's true that in the last analysis, the government ends up being the guarantor, but there's no reason why the bank shareholders shouldn't make some contribution to the insurance.
It won't be just bank shareholders. We can all expect to pay a little more for FDIC peace of mind through higher banking fees. I'm Mitchell Hartman for Marketplace.
Pilgrim's Pride announced today it's going to shut down three chicken processing plants in the southeastern part of the United States. That'll be another 3,000 people out of work, and there will no doubt be stiff competition for any new jobs that do happen to open up, even the ones that in better times were hard to fill. That would include school cafeteria workers, too. You remember them, right? The people who sling the Jell-O, serve up the burgers, and stand on their feet all day. Occupational hazards aside, demand for those lunchroom jobs has more than tripled in some places. From Birmingham, Alabama, Gigi Duban reports.
Bonnie Mahari is used to coming home smelling like greasy food. She worked at the omelet shop in Birmingham, Alabama for 20 years and then quit. But Mahari is a single mom. She has three kids, and her child support recently dropped by a third.
Money. Needed the money.
The big expense? How to pay for education.
Well, I have a daughter in college. Very costly. So, it's either go back to work or she don't get to go to college.
So Mahari got a job last fall as a cafeteria worker at Pleasant Grove Elementary School.
There you go. Get you a napkin.
Everybody needs work. We have very good benefits. The pay's not bad. It's a job.
Ice cream?
It's by no means a glamorous job. You remember the bright smocks, the black sneakers, the hairnets? But Mahari doesn't mind. Neither do a lot of people these days. Just look at the number of applicants for lunchroom jobs in the local school system.
In the past, we would get 10 to 12. We're getting 37, 47 now.
Nathan Hayes is child nutrition supervisor for Jefferson County Schools. He says not only are more people applying, they're not balking as much about the pay.
That's what a lot of people right now are saying. Now, you know what, the money's great, I like making extra money, but hey, I'll take a job paying less, for more stability when I know I can bank on that job being here tomorrow.
But there was a time when hardly anyone wanted to be the lunch lady. Take Rebecca Jones. Back when she started 25 years ago, she just wanted a job that would get her out of the house while her kids were at school.
It just fit in. I was home when they were at home. We were off together, so it gave me more time with my family.
But then things changed. Her husband got laid off from the coal mines, and work wasn't just for kicks anymore. Today, Jones is the lunchroom manager at Pleasant Grove. Here's the worst part of her job. Jones spends hours tracking down moms who haven't sent in lunch money. She says since the economic downturn, she's evolved into a sort of bill collector.
She has $1.90, so she's got enough for today. All right, thank you.
So they need a little shaking down.
Yeah. Turning them upside down, seeing how much they got in their pocket.
That's because they need a Tony Soprano working there.
But while the economic strains have added a few twists, some parts of the job haven't changed a bit. The lunch ladies still sit down to have their own lunch at 10 in the morning. They still get summers off, and the pay is still pretty low, $13 an hour here. Jones says she never imagined she'd have stayed in this job for as long as she has. And even though she's eligible for retirement now, she can't call it quits just yet. Her husband is retired and sick. But even though Jones and her newest hire, Bonnie Mahari, are working to make ends meet, something else takes the sting out of the economic hardship.
I just love working with kids. That makes my day. These little kids will tell you anything. You can't ask questions or anything, but sometimes you know when they're having a bad day by the way they look at you. And you learn about their parents.
These are, incidentally, the same parents that Jones fed when she first started working at the high school 25 years ago. In Birmingham, I'm Gigi Duban for Marketplace.
Marketplace is supported by Putnam Investments, offering absolute return funds with goals designed to match yours. Details at Putnam.com. Additional support from the University of Southern California's Marshall School of Business.
This final note in which I deliver the news, you decide what it means. The CEO of the Irish discount airline Ryanair has a new plan to increase the company's cash flow. Michael O'Leary told the BBC in an interview today that he's thinking of charging passengers to use the toilet, putting a coin slot right on the door. Here comes the part where you decide what it means. While his latest idea does sound a bit much, O'Leary, after all, is the guy who came up with the idea of charging passengers to check their bags. A spokesman said today, in all seriousness, that while having passengers pay for bathroom privileges has been discussed within the company, there are no immediate plans for it. To which you say, thank goodness for little favors, I suppose. That is Marketplace from American Public Media this Friday afternoon. Today, the Dow dropped 119 points, 1 2/3%. The NASDAQ lost 13 points, just under 1%. The S&P 500 fell 17 points, 2 1/3%. Our theme music was composed by B.J. Lederman. Marketplace is produced by Celeste West, and the executive producer of the program is J.J. Yule. Coming up on Monday, creating a bank you can trust.
To go back into the old bad banks and fix it will be very difficult. But to create good banks that start from the scratch from this perspective, I think, would be relatively easier.
I'm Kai Rizdal. Have yourself a great weekend.
American Public Media.
All over the country,
we need to improve reading in Wisconsin.
Schools are changing the way they teach reading.
I'm calling for a renewed focus on literacy.
We have gotten this wrong in New York and all across the nation.
And it's happening because of a podcast.
I think your podcast has changed my life.
And I'm going to share this podcast with everyone I meet.
Sold a Story investigates how teaching kids to read went wrong. New episodes of Sold a Story are available now.